I don't think the Puritans killed any Baptists. I could be wrong. I mean, don't get me wrong. Baptist. It's hard to avoid killing Baptists.
Yes. Well, we're hard to kill. Most conventional weaponry is, we're immune to it. I'm watching in Argentina.
Like drowning? You guys are amphibious, right?
Yes, yes. We can be immersed and do just fine. Of course.
What are you watching?
Not before we're in the covenant. No, I'm watching a Argentinian conductor named Gustavo Dudamel.
Oh, yeah, sure.
You know him?
No.
Big, oh, him. Yeah, yeah. Why would you? You just stay in your Denver apartment looking at books of pictures of corn. That
bro,
you miss
I'm
from.
Going to a party on Thursday night. Come on, son.
Is it? Wait, hold on. I got to turn you up. I cannot hear you.
Hello? Hello?
All right, that's much better. You're going to a party. What was it? What is it about?
Yeah. It's well, you might not know this, but the year is going to end in about 2 days.
Right. Yeah.
Oh,
right.
And we're going to start a new one.
So is this with friendlies? Is this friendly fire you're about to engage in? Or new
people? Yeah. It's cooperative play, as you would say.
Oh, yes. Is it RPCNA people, your church?
Yeah. Yeah. It's all church people.
I hear those people know how to party. Yeah.
We actually do. We're last man night. Somebody brought. Have you seen these lollipops called the Devil's Tongue?
No. I'm guessing it's spicy, right?
Yeah. So there's a unit of spiciness. Hold on. Ghost pepper spiciness.
It's called Scoville, my brother. Scoville
spiciness.
Scale.
Oh, I should put that in follow up. Hold on. Number. So the ghost pepper that a lot of people have heard of has a Scoville score of about 1 million. 41,427. These lollipops are 9 million. So a bunch of guys tried them. We only had three of them. We shared. I did not partake in this. It sounded very unpleasant.
I couldn't imagine you sharing a lollipop with St. Peter. I mean, it just wouldn't work.
Yeah, then somebody brought some handguns and we all kind of held them because there was nowhere to shoot and we're in the city, but we all held them. And what was the other thing? Oh, there was much snacking and smoking and alcohol.
Hey, Greg, did you bring your 9mm? Yeah, here it is. Can I just hold it? Sure.
Well, he had Presbyterians holding their guns, but
what?
Bullets that don't even make a sound. Like when you pull the trigger, they're like placeholder bullets, if you will.
Yes.
So you could like pull the trigger and feel the action, as you would say.
Yes, the dummy round. Is it like a dummy round, basically?
You would know about dummy rounds.
Yeah, wouldn't I? Big fat
I felt like
rounds.
That was
going to get out of your jokes right now.
That was going too far, maybe. It was a twofer, and I feel bad. I'm sorry.
No, you don't. You never have.
I do feel bad.
Will.
I do. I mean, not very bad, but I never feel very good either.
I'm just, that's pretty accurate. Well, all right. well, now that we're starting the show off on a great, on a good footing, on a good, solid Presbyterian versus Baptist footing. yeah, this is our banter segment, so we got to make this stuff up. Or we can just end it here. End it here and now. Anyways, I don't know what I'm doing. Let's start the show.
The podcast you are about to hear contains the histrionic and problematic conversations of a stodgy Presbyterian and a casserole-loving Baptist. Their interactions are volatile at times and unpleasant most of the time. In many nations, this is considered a mild form of torture. We strongly advise you to stop this nonsense and go do something useful with your life. Otherwise, if you insist on listening to this mess, welcome to the lightest form of flogging.
Thank you, Deep Voice Man. I also welcome you to the Lightest Form of Flogging podcast, episode 122. Double deuce, as they say. One stone and two deuces.
Drop a deuce on everyone.
Yeah, I am your defeated lobster host, Jim, and sitting across the country from me in a contractually negotiated 824 miles is my co-host, David. And while he has never technically quit the show, he has co-hosted alongside me under considerable duress. Yeah. And not a lot of tooth pain, apparently. So the pain in your jaw is from me, not your bacteria on your teeth.
Mm, or my sinuses. It might be
possibly a combination of the two. Hey, show, we're here.
We are.
Yeah, we need more energy. You know, I've been listening to the shows. We need to pump it up here. You know, you and I, we're getting complacent in our and our longevity. And we need to get, I'm just looking at your face of the camera right now. You have no interest in reciprocating excitement, but that's
okay.
I will provide it for the both of us.
I was organizing bullet points.
Now that makes you happy. That makes you happy inside. So I know that when
I love hierarchical thinking.
Yes.
But we'll get into that later.
I'm sure we will. Okay. So let's go ahead and do some follow-up. Actually, I don't have any follow-up, which is kind of weird. So
wow.
I'm going to go ahead and.
Is that a follow-up point?
I guess it is. So I'm going to defer to you.
Okay.
As I normally do.
You have one follow-up.
Baptism, covenants, hypostatic.
Jim has one follow-up point, which is that he has no further follow-up.
I do.
Rating roast beef, listener Ben Robin, from whom we have not heard in some time. I almost ended that sentence in a preposition like an animal, pointed out that the irony of doing an episode about spectrum versus category thinking, yes, and how I don't like spectrum thinking. And then, you know, and talking about how, when you have a complex matrix of components, or components, as you would say, that make up, how you can define a thing, putting one number on it as a label is just silly. You know, that's what I had been saying. And then when we talked about the roast beef sandwich at Arby's, I gave it a 5.5 out of 10 or an 11 out of 20.
That hurt me.
And I did that on purpose. It was supposed to be ironic. And listener Ben is the only person who at least told me that he noticed.
Well, like, but why would you want to get a reaction out of someone for saying something like that? Like, you know, switching rating system.
No, I mean, that's... Yeah, I was expecting maybe chortles from some of our audience.
Oh, okay.
I just wanted to point out, because I don't know if anybody noticed that it was supposed to be ironic.
What now?
That's probably true.
Okay, all right. Well, I'm glad.
Next,
I'm glad we're hearing from Ben, because we miss Ben. We haven't had Ben on the show in a long time. He reached out to us months ago with the topic, and we just kind of went, eh. So we got to get him back in the show here pretty soon.
Back in the show. Next up, he's busy. I will tell you
Sure
he told me he's busy.
Getting PhDs.
Next up, Podcaster is now a part of the About page on and the rest of it. And it links to The Lightest Form of Flogging.
Good man.
Jim will be happy.
Good man. One of the nine shows.
It was always in the projects section. If you went to projects and saw the things that I was working on, Lightest Form of Flogging was always there. Now it's also one of the adjectives. Sorry, my camera's not.
Okay. Oh. Well, as long as it's something... As long as it's something you're still working on, great.
Next up is the Scottish Covenanter ad that Jim slotted in. The Covenant air horn.
Yeah.
Of course, I did that accent, and I thought that it was okay up until I said 9.95, which sounded very distinctly Irish. And I just wanted to apologize.
Every time
I hear that ad, I'm like, That whole like string of words from 9.95 forwards and backwards, like five words, give or take, is just faintly Irish. And then like it's a chiasm that culminates in an Irish accent.
Yes. I think I did notice that, but it was more charming than it was offensive. So, I mean,
it was offensive to me because I was trying for a Scottish accent.
This reminds me of there's a guy in my church who is at a different campus. We have multiple campuses at our church. As you remember or know or not want to know or not care about, don't not care about anymore or hate. I don't know.
Oh,
there's
care.
Maybe a lot of emotions that come out of you when I say that we have multiple campuses. But anyways, he's from Ireland and he still has his Irish accent and he's been in here a number of years and he isn't one of those foreigners that comes to live in a foreign land and loses his accent. You know, like Mel Gibson is Australian and he has an American accent right now.
Crikey, I didn't know that.
Crikey. It's the German.
From Germany. Yeah, from Germany.
Like
all those people in Lost.
Yes. that made me cough. So this guy is an Irish accent and I fancy myself as a cunning mimic who can do an Irish accent as well as a Scottish accent. And I said something to him in what I thought
Don't
was a Scottish.
That. Oh no.
I'm sorry. What I thought was an Irish accent. And he said like right away with disdain, he said, that's a Scottish accent. And like, I never did it again in front of I mean, we're not friends, but friendly
enough Scottish accent
for me to try again, but I never did because it hurt me. So
you just have to picture the leprechaun on Lucky Charms.
I guess you do. Yeah. And like for Scottish accent, just think about the movie Braveheart and just, you know, say it.
Or Groundskeeper Willie. That's what I do.
Groundskeeper Willie. That's a good one. But just all that, all that to say, I think you did great. You know, expectations aren't too high when it comes to being that
that's true.
Consistent.
I have high expectations though.
But that would be hard to say, I guess.
Of me.
It was just making noises. Anyways,
Lastly here, this might be penultimately. I will let Jim decide. Mm. But penultimately or ultimately, I have the flogging carol. I just really appreciate, Jim, how you wove the original verbiage from A Christmas Carol throughout the book in various ways. Like, you just, that must have been a project. I mean, you probably had the book open while you were writing, and you were taking tidbits and then altering them to fit. And I just have to say, you did a really good job. The writing on that was really good.
Yes. Thank you very much. I did put a little work into that, which is one of the reasons why I like to replay it. Because it's not just one of our flippant bits that you or I wrote 5 minutes before the show.
You hear it here first. Most of Jim's bits are flippant.
Have you listened to them? but that one, I mean, I put some work into some of them, but actually you and I both put work into that one. You, I believe, were like an editor of sorts, and even Sarah might have gave it a read. You know what I mean?
It's been like, oh yeah, that may be true. Yeah, it's been like 3 years. I don't even remember.
But I think it's funny enough to merit a third broadcast. So maybe, I don't know if we'll do it next year, but we'll see. It's really for the new listeners. The old listeners, they don't care about us anymore. So I don't want to. Anyways, but thank you for that. Our crowning achievement.
So lastly, or perhaps not at all, I have a question for Jim, which is,
all right,
do you consider talking about not talking about something to be talking about it?
You did that on purpose. You knew I wouldn't get that.
I'm sorry. I said it very quickly. Okay. Do you consider talking about not talking about something to be talking about it?
I don't think so, but there, I think so. The line is crossed frequently.
Should we talk about Lost this week? Or does our discussion about not discussing it last week constitute discussing it?
That was just for that episode.
Okay.
I want to talk about it every episode.
Right. I get that.
To respect our listeners' sanity, because like there's only like 5 or 6 Lost fans on the planet. It's like a severe, it's like a really hated show. And, the only thing people hate more than the show Lost are Lost fans that still exist. And I am complete and total 100% Lost fan. So, but yes, well, let's talk about it.
So we've been kind of intentionally trying to unwind in the evenings lately because there's just been a lot going on sure. with Sarah's work and her business. And well, actually mostly it's busyness. Sarah's stuff. Well, it's busyness causing stress.
Okay.
So we've just kind of been very intentional. So all of that to say, we just finished season 1.
Okay, we got to talk about it, man. So you've been going along at a fairly rapid clip. What was that like?
Yeah, I mean, it's not crazy fast. Like, I mean, it was
3 episodes a week, 4-ish?
Yeah, maybe 4 or 5, yeah.
Okay.
Probably about 4, yeah.
So what do you think? A lot of people think that season 1 was maybe not the best, but maybe the most unique of the seasons. Like, there are none that are like it. It's just a singular season. It's just, it won the Emmy for best show that year. So it was
interesting. Yeah. I mean, we're hooked now. I mean, I can't imagine not finishing the series unless it just gets really bad all of a sudden. I'm not sure what to say. I mean, it's not that I'm trying to avoid spoilers. I just don't want to get too caught up in the weeds. I love, right. this is classic Abrams. I think that Abrams, he talks about this in a YouTube interview at some point, which I'm sure wasn't originally for YouTube, but whatever. He talks about
magic box or something.
Yes. He talks about the magic box that was some plot element in some show that inspired his career in Hollywood. And he's very, very into the whole, like, here's a bunch of things that are happening because of something that you don't know what it is. And we're not going to tell you, and you're just going to watch and wonder, I guess would be like the catchphrase for Abrams. And so more than anything else that he has made, I feel like this was his playground to get to do that. And he's very good at it.
Yeah.
I should say that at a certain point when I stepped into Lost watching on episode like 5 or something, when my parents were watching it, one of the reasons I was so confused was because of the flashbacks. Because the flashbacks are not classic flashbacks where they like flash to white and then show like a differently color graded segment or something. There's no like weird echo. It's just like,
oh, there are no clues in, oh, I mean, there usually there are clues.
This is a flashback. And so I was very confused because I thought they were simultaneously on and off the island, or like some of them had left and some of them had decided to stay. And that was the piece of confusing thing for me that like they never talked about or resolved. Right. That was just very upsetting. Like, why do people want to come back to this island? Like, what's going on? And so now,
like your initial aversion maybe to it.
Yes.
Like you just didn't watch after that and just kind of put it out of your mind.
Right. Because that was too much for me. That was like, I can't latch on to this if I don't even know like why these people are off the island, how they got off and why these people are still on the island, which is, I mean, for all I know, later in the series, people do get off the island. I have no idea. But I was just very confused because there wasn't, yeah, the flashbacks were not, it's not that they weren't done well. If you watch from the beginning, it's very clear that they're flashbacks.
Okay,
But if because you just they give hop that sound in,
effect. They give the sound effect.
Is there a sound effect?
Yeah, there's a sound effect that they use for every flashback.
Oh, okay.
But also that there's I think like 3 or 4 segments of the episode that are flashbacks, but they do give a sound effect.
And usually they'll show like a character thinking.
Yeah.
Like that's enough. Not all the time, but often. Anyway, it is obvious enough, but if you hop in halfway through an episode and you're like, oh, I wonder what this is, which is like, it sounds funny that I'm talking about this to people whose primary experience watching TV is streaming, because it's like, why would you do that? But that's not how like broadcast television used to work. It used to be very important that your show, if you came in 33 minutes into a 42 minute episode or an hour episode with commercials, it was very important that like you could grok what was going on. And that's why everything would be over explained and explained more than once and on and on. Lost just kind of ignored that. Lost was more built for streaming maybe than it was for broadcast TV in that sense.
Yeah. I wonder, I think it came out, I think 2004, 2005, something like that. Mm. And I don't think a show at that time or before, displayed its narrative like Lost did. So it was very new, both in that they didn't really clue you in on everything that they were doing.
The right.
Flashbacks were probably confusing at first because there were multiple ones, and they don't exactly tell you the purpose of the flashbacks. You don't get why these particular flashbacks for this particular character, why are they going back to this place in life? Sometimes those questions aren't answered for multiple seasons. Just throwing that out. Hopefully that won't be a detriment to your enjoyment of it, but it might also fuel your excitement to see what happens, because I think I figured out what I want to say about season one. I think I did say that it's probably the best season. I don't mean it that way. What I mean is, of the Magic Box, season one is probably Abrams' best Magic Box. It's his most alluring Magic Box, the most interesting Magic Box.
Title.
Hey, there you go. Because from that point on, I mean, the first season is your first exposure to all of this, to the Magic Box of Abrams. Seasons 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 are just repeats. There's more flashbacks. They go through the characters probably twice. They cycle through all the characters twice for their own-centric episodes. Mm-hmm. So there's more repetition, but it's really just, you know, a bullet goes through and pokes a hole, and then it starts draining. But then you have to start putting more water or mystery into the box or the barrel. So they just do that for the rest of the seasons. And sometimes there are more bullets puncturing the barrel, and sometimes there's more water being poured into the barrel. But yeah, the Magic Box thing is going to continue. I'm curious what's going to happen when you guys get to season two or go through it. Non-Lost fans did not like it. I think hardcore Lost fans like season two. I personally like season two a lot, but it's going to shift in tone a little bit. The characters are really going to start to change. Not in bad ways. But if you fall in love with the character from season one and expect them to stay that way, it's not going to happen.
Oh, because I love Hurley.
No, he's still around. And they all retain their likability or the thing that makes you like them. Jack is always going to be the leader. But he is going to change in many different ways that will probably change your perception of him. He's not going to be the same Jack from season one. In fact, that goes away. I can't say that. I got to be careful what I say here. But Hurley is still going to be very charming and funny and lovable. But
As long as that continues, I feel like we can continue to watch it, because
you're going to like Hurley.
If there's one thing I've learned from this show, it's that a really likable, chubby fellow can really hook people. Sorry, by this show, I meant Lost. I don't know what, yeah, what you thought I was
show.
Talking
not,
about.
Not this show. That has not happened. The Linus Romanus manga. I am not the Hurley. I am more like the Sawyer of this show. But no,
that I'm guy excited. Just always looks like somebody spilled soup on him. Like he's just, what? What it's not mean? Even his soup. Like he's just sitting there as an innocent bystander as some waiter spills somebody else's soup on him and he's just mad.
Well, he's mad about something.
He's indignant. But
no. Well, that's great. So in terms of story, are you intrigued by what's happening? You start to kind of get the mystery of the island.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and yeah, everything with John Locke, I like a lot of the things surrounding him and just trying to understand why he thinks he understands what's going on.
Something special about him, as they say, right?
Well, yeah.
Communion with the island that no other character has.
But you don't know if he does or doesn't. Like there are times where he just, well, like getting Boone killed, you know, I feel like it's safe to discuss spoilers from season one of Lost at this point.
Right.
It's, you know,
many years,
all
old.
These 17 years later.
I can just hear a guy out in our audience universe
like,
taking his iPod and just, you know, iPod, right. And smashing it on the ground once he hears, what? I can't believe it.
He's like, that was too, that they would kill off a major character like that.
Yeah, it was shocking.
Yeah.
It was shocking. Boone was a good character.
Well, and the school teacher too. It was a little disappointing. I wish they had given him a little bit more backstory.
I agree.
Even just integrating him into one or two other episodes would have made me connect with him more.
Yeah. Well, let me just say, I'm not going to tell you how or why, but you'll see him again. But yeah, you're right.
I mean, I saw him in a flashback.
No, what I mean is in future seasons.
Oh, okay.
But yeah. Well, great. I'm glad that I'm glad you guys are hooked and you're liking it and you're enjoying it. That tells me. I was just worried that when you would express your comments about that show to me before, I was just like, I just don't understand. It seems like David would like the show. And I don't understand why he's so like averse to it, but now I understand. So it makes a lot more sense now.
All right. Well, with 1.5 hour left, you want to dive into our main topic, Jim?
Yeah, let's do that. But before we do, let's go ahead and take a quick musical break, your favorite part of the show, and then we'll be right back.
I love this part of the show.
Right, we're back. Separate saddles, separate horses, but back in the saddle again. Okay, slight diversion from our usual shows. David and I are going to do something fun today. We're going to do an inaugural, not sure what really to call this. I guess it's a new series. Let's just say
this is book club.
Yeah, that's right. You called it. We're doing a book club. Sometimes podcasts go through books, talk about the chapters, review it, whatever, discuss. David's going to call
You know what we should do after this?
What's that?
Is we just eat breakfast and talk about it. We can have a breakfast club.
And yeah, and we'll do it at a place called Tiffany's. It's going to be great. So we're going to do a book club. It's going to be a strange selection probably for some, but for some it might make sense. But we're going to go through a certain book by a guy named Jordan Peterson. His second book called 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos. So this is the book that kind of launched him into superstardom. He wrote a book before this, but it was really just for academia. But
I listened to the intro and I wish I hadn't.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I also,
it was kind of interesting because the intro was just so like, oh, this is the kind of thing that like 20-year-old me would write. Where like, here's a bunch of backstory about how this book came to be. And it kind of gave me a bad taste and I just wasn't expecting the rest of the book to be better. And then about halfway through chapter one, I was like, I'll bet they made him write that because that doesn't seem like something he would want to do.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I think the true strength of the book starts at chapter one and not before. Mm. There's a cute little foreword by, I think, a colleague of his. And then, yes, he writes an intro as to why he wrote the book. But I think the reasons why this book exists are relevant and are interesting, I think.
Mm.
Because he is kind of like a pop culture figure at this point, for better or for worse. And it's not all for positive reasons. I mean, there are a lot of Jordan Peterson fans, and I do say that on purpose. He is kind of like a media figure.
A celebrity pastor who's not a pastor.
Celebrity. There you go. A celebrity psychologist? I don't know. Celebrity professor?
I like that. He's the new Dr. Phil.
Maybe. Yeah, he's the much more academic Dr. Phil, I guess. But anyways, but
Dr.
a lot of
Philip.
So a lot of people like him, but a lot of people really, really, really hate him. And there are numerous reasons for that. But how I got turned on to this guy was his YouTube channel. As I'm sure you've probably seen a few clips on YouTube of Peterson doing a variety of different things.
I have.
Juggling. No.
That was my favorite, actually.
Yeah. Lectures, public appearances, debates.
Memes.
But he got quite a few. What? Memes?
Memes.
Okay.
The meme of, so what you're saying is?
Right. Very famous interview with a British journalist where she was mischaracterizing his arguments right in front of him. And he called her out and really, really nailed her for it. And it was a pretty glorious moment. But anyways, this guy is known for a lot of things, but he's a pretty sharp thinker, very quick on his feet, very good with words, and often performs very well in his debates or public appearances. And that's all on YouTube. So there's lots of material for people to consume. And he's just grown this cult following over time. And a very curious aspect of this guy's celebrity is that he has a lot of Christian fans, a lot of them. Mm-hmm. Like you've been, you are on the Facebook group, The Reform Pub, and probably Peterson discussions show up from time to time. And
actually, Les Lanfear was literally just asking the question of like, why does everybody like this guy? I think this was on his profile, but
oh, right.
I thought that was really interesting because he literally asked it today as I finished chapter one.
It's a relevant question. I bet you there are lots of Christian thinkers. Not that Les Lanfear, he's a Christian and he's a thinker. But what I mean is there are a lot of people like asking. So, you know, I get that, you know, you can like a guy's YouTube material or his books, but Jordan Peterson is not a traditional Christian celebrity. He isn't.
Right.
In fact, I'm fairly certain that he's not a Christian at all. He's given no indications up until this point that he is. And I think we would know by now, and he would probably vocalize it by now. He's speaking largely from a secular perspective, a secular academic psychologist perspective. He's openly an admirer of certain psychological figures or figures in psychiatry that, like Sigmund Freud.
Right. Well, and he's an evolutionist, which is, I mean,
also
not to dive too far into the book, but like a lot of his argumentation in chapter one comes from evolution.
Certainly does. And so you would put all this together and you would think, so this probably does not make a celebrity Christian thinker. It really doesn't. But yet here he is. And I think one of the reasons why is because the book we're about to talk about, I think could be characterized safely as like a self-help book.
Yep.
You know, just at its simplest. It's exactly what it is. And there are a lot of self-help books out there that Christians have access to, but have never really gotten tuned into it or really excited
Although,
about it.
Although, what was that one by that Mormon guy?
I think I know what you're talking about. Talking about Wild at Heart?
No, I don't think he was a Mormon, was he?
I'm just guessing.
LDS Living, Six Popular Self-Help, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People by Stephen Covey, in which he says, just love her. To a man about his wife.
Well, that's
over and over and over again.
So it's just, those are the 7 points. Point one. No.
Just love her. I'm doing a CGP Grey bit, but
okay,
it's fine.
Well, it's certainly good advice. But this guy publishes a self-help book and it is a cultural phenomenon. And I know it's been published many years or it was published numerous years ago and we're now just getting around to talking about it. So we might be a little bit late to the party, but he is about to release a sequel to this book in a couple of months. I think he's calling it like 12 More Rules for Life. But basically this book is 12 truisms or maxims based off of his experience and learning that he is giving to his readers to bring order to chaos. So that's kind of my exposure to Jordan Peterson and kind of setting the stage for why we're doing this. Do you have any comments as to, as a matter of fact, David, I think you're actually the one who mentioned this to us, to you and I, to actually do this. Do you remember that?
I suggested doing like selected chapters or maybe a book if the whole thing was relevant, but doing selected chapters from a book. I think the book itself was your idea.
Okay. I guess. Because
prior to you mentioning it, I didn't know he had written a book. So.
So you're like Les Lanfear in which you have not jumped onto this crazy Jordan Peterson bandwagon.
Yeah.
Not that you are going to.
But, yeah. I mean, everything I've seen from him in like memes or people posting to Twitter or, you know, quotes, whatever, I've been like, oh, that seems reasonable. I do get him confused with James Jordan a lot, for whom I really feel no affection. So
who's James Jordan? I don't know.
He's a Federal Vision guy.
Ah, well, I hear those people are really popular with the Sheologians crowd. sorry. James White loves them. No, I'm kidding. That's a cruel joke. It's not a joke. It's not even a joke. It's slander. Absolute slander. I could be sued by James White. Man, I'm going to frame that summons.
That should be your Twitter bio. So,
yeah, it's going to go on my Twitter bio. All that to say, this may seem a little bit counterintuitive, but I mean, what better topic for us to talk about than self-help, because we are, after all, the quintessential, podcast about hosted by two depressed guys in their 30s, and we're white. This is like, we're just quintessential podcasting.
For the record, I'm not depressed. Jim is just depressed enough for both of us, so it's like two depressed guys.
Well, good. Is that the joke, though? Like,
why do white men in their 30s start podcasts instead of going to therapy? Was a tweet that I saw recently.
Yes, I saw it. Yes, and that's exactly what we're doing. So we're going to talk. We're going to be two white guys doing a podcast, and we're going to talk about self-help book. So this is really on brand.
All right. So because Jim has a limited amount of time, I'm going to play the role of chief summarizer in chief here. And before I do that, Jim, you outlined this book like it was your homework assignment in college.
Yes.
Like you even have here pages 16 to 17, which is useless to me because I'm using an ebook and an audio book.
Yes.
But
I did this.
I just want to appreciate, like, this is maybe the most work you've ever put into a topic.
Oh, I put in, good point. That's a fair point.
It's on par anyway.
I did this because I wanted to facilitate the discussion.
Yes.
And I didn't want to miss anything. And there's a lot of material. There's a lot of concept ideas in this chapter. And I didn't want to make sure I put it all on there. Not that we were going to talk about all this, but I accept your proposal for you to kind of briskly kind of summarize this, but go ahead.
So Jordan Peterson, I almost said James Jordan. I literally almost said James Jordan.
I thought you were about to say J.I. Packer or something.
Jordan Peterson wrote an answer to a question on Quora, with 12 principles for life when somebody was asking, how do I live my life? That's what this book came out of. We're talking about chapter one, the principle of stand up straight with your shoulders back. And the summary of that, as best I can say, borrowing heavily from Jim's outline here, is because there are more losers than winners, but winners... Wait, that's not even a sentence. Sorry, I'm calling an audible here.
That's why I'm doing this, because it's my writing. I know how to do it.
I know, but I don't want to go through all of this. The argument that he makes is that winners who win tend to win more, and losers who lose tend to lose less. So if you act like you are a winner, you are putting yourself in a position where people may recognize that, and you may actually win more. So what should you do? Stand up straight with your shoulders back.
That's a great summary, actually, David. That was really good. There's a lot of content in that.
A lot about lobsters. Like a lot. I picture him like Homer Simpson picking out a lobster and then raising it as his own until it becomes Mega Lobster and like taking it to the fair with him.
What do you think about all that lobster stuff?
What?
I know you weren't expecting to read about lobsters in a chapter like this that tells you to stand up straight with your shoulders back. So what do you think about, what did you think about that? Was it insightful? Was it silly to you? Cause he got a lot of flack.
Yeah.
For this.
So this is, I have no issues. One of the things that he talks about in this is, the dominance hierarchy, that people who win tend to act like they win, and people who lose tend to act like they lose. And maybe a good like human example of this is high school. Like the quarterback who's always making successful passes tends to make more successful passes because his brain is in the spot where he actually thinks he can do it. Whereas the kid who tried out for the team and failed is even more likely to fail next time because of all the anxiety and all the stress and all the, what does he say here? There's a chemical that he uses here. Serotonin versus
serotonin.
Anyway, it doesn't really matter. And he uses lobsters as this example where you watch them, lobsters will fight over territory because territory is important, because basically their job is to collect bits of discarded meat from animals who die above them. Discarded meat, meaning like limbs or things that fall off. And he talks about how a lobster who loses, his brain chemistry changes in a very massive way. And because of that, he tends to lose. He tends to pull away. He tends to run away. He tends to just become this like fetal position occupying shell of a shellfish. And shell of a crustacean. I'm looking for a title. Anyway, and it was very interesting. And so where I have to draw a line here, because I'm a Christian and I'm a 6-day creationist. And even if I wasn't a 6-day creationist, even if I was like old earth for some reason, I still wouldn't necessarily buy into the whole evolution thing. And so I have to draw a line and say, while that's a really good illustration of how humans behave, and it seems like you can draw a parallel between God's design in lobsters and God's design in humans, he draws a causal relationship. And I have to like pull back and say, no. It's not because our great ancestors, the lobsters, were this way that we are this way. It's simply, this is how God has designed the world. And he even alludes to what he calls the Matthew principle, which doesn't make any sense. In terms of naming, there's lots of principles in Matthew, but he talks about how Jesus says, those who have many, or those who have much more will be given, those who have less, even what they have will be taken away.
Sometimes that is referred to as, I believe, the Matthew 24.
I would maybe allow a chapter number in there. That might make more sense.
Okay. All right.
So, I don't draw, like, I imagine that there are people who just don't want the world to work this way. Like people who,
right. This isn't positive. I mean, there's, based off of his explanations, there are a lot of more people in the loser lobster category than the winner lobster category.
Right. Like, yeah. And so that doesn't bother me. Like, I get that that's how the world works, and I didn't have any objections there. And I imagine the reason a lot of people are objecting is because they are kind of snowflakes. Like, it's kind of interesting because as I was reading this and listening to it, I was thinking about how the world would object to this, how specifically like modern people would want to say it shouldn't be this way. And our solution is communism, or something akin to communism. And while like, the real solution I think is kindness. Like, kindness is a good solution. Government imposed kindness
is
just putting the big lobsters in charge and expecting that they'll be benevolent, which they won't.
Right. We need to get Christian.
My whole thing, Jim.
Yes. And hey, I believe there is room for that,
but I don't want to delve too deep into
Peterson
politics.
Would disagree, but I get what you're saying.
When you asked me, I'm trying to move the discussion along. So stop me if there's like a thing in here that you really want to talk about, but I just recognize we don't have a lot of time.
It's okay. Don't worry about the clock.
I messaged you and was like, this is really interesting. I think it explains a lot about me. And also I think it explains why guys become youth pastors / youth leaders. Of course, because youth leaders are one of the lowest forms of crustaceans. Apologies if you're a youth leader. I am mostly sorry for that comment.
Not really. I resonated with that first point, but the youth leader, I wanted to hear more about what you meant by that. But I think you're right. I believe this describes me too. This is my 30s, basically. I was a loser lobster in my 30s and I didn't even
know. Yeah. So maybe feel free to cut in here because I think our stories are going to be fairly similar. But like for me, I had no idea what I was doing with my life. And I think that I had I was picked on as a kid. I was bullied, but not in the like, you know, strung up by my underwear on the flagpole, more like Christian bullying, which can still be like really humiliating. Like I was dragged around by my socks on a trampoline for 10 minutes or whatever. Like there were things that happened to me that made me feel like, oh, I'm a loser. Like that is my place in life. Man. And I think my mom struggled with depression and she struggled with the thought that like, I'm a loser. And because she was bullied far worse in high school than I was. And so a lot of that seeped into me, and where that left me going into like my early 20s, you know, from 19 to 20 was, I don't even think that I can like flip burgers. Like, I don't think that I can do anything. He talks about the example of agoraphobia. It's not that I had agoraphobia. I had like workplace-a-phobia or like competence-a-phobia.
Yeah. It seemed more like the journey to agoraphobia is a lower place on the dominance hierarchy or a low score.
Right.
And that's, it's just self-perpetuating. It just makes it worse and worse. And more is taken away from.
Yeah. And he talks about the positive feedback loop where, you know, if something bad happens, you react poorly to it, which makes you more likely to remember how badly it went the next time and react even more poorly, which makes it go even worse that time. And he in the example we're talking about, he's talking about the woman who goes to the mall and gets some kind of anxiety attack. And because of that, she thinks she's having a heart attack. So then she goes to the emergency room and turns out there's nothing wrong. But then the next time she goes to the mall, she decides not even to go to the mall because she's afraid of a heart attack. So she goes back home. And then her brain kind of rewards her because it's like, oh, you did the good thing. You didn't go into danger. And now it's like really permanently attached danger to the mall. I feel like something similar was happening to me, but not with malls and large groups of people, although I've never been comfortable around those. But more like, sure. Actually, I'm much more comfortable in a mall or like on a busy street where I don't know anybody than I am in a large group of people that I do know, but that's neither here nor there.
Yeah, I hear you.
So I think I was caught in something like that. And for me, and this is where the youth pastor thing comes in. For me, what pulled me out of that was I started doing youth ministry. And just so listeners know, I'm generally not at all in favor of youth ministry unless it comes from a minister who also ministers to adults, because I don't see the office of youth pastor or youth minister in scripture. I'm fine with pastors deciding I'm a pastor and I see a need for something for my youth and I'm going to hold some sort of event and preach to them or have pizza or have conversations or whatever. Like, I'm fine with that. Where I draw the line is like, well, we don't trust this guy with the kid, with the adults. So let's put him with the kids. That seems bananas to me and like the opposite of intelligence. But that was exactly what I fell into. And the thing about kids is they're very easily impressed. Like, at least at that age, as long as you're not their parents, there's a high probability that they will think like, oh, you know how to use Photoshop? That's amazing, because I'm 12 and like, I have no idea how to do anything because I'm 12. And so there was an establishment of competence in something for me at that time. At that time, I saw people who actually looked up to me, which was not an experience I had had my entire life. And that made me as a lobster able to stand up a little bit more straight and pursue that particular career path. And of course, later I found out that that was not the career path. Like, youth pastor/pastor was not the career path for me at all, but it gave me the confidence to believe that I could possess competence. That was not supposed to be as jingly as it sounded.
Okay. No, this is good, because I think my experience largely mirrors this. My biggest takeaway was, yes, I mean, when I read the stuff about the lobsters at the time, I knew that there was going to be a disconnect, because a lot of that is based in his evolutionary paradigm, that they have these characteristics and we do too because of evolution and shared characteristics or things like that. And because you can observe the neural pathways of a lobster's brain, therefore that it also occurs in other animals' brains like ours. And so, yeah, I do recognize that. But I guess to the extent that there were takeaways, I did try to extract them. And one of them was I really latched on to his the dominance hierarchy that he says we are in. And I think to some extent, I do agree that that's basically how we operate. And that's what we are in right now in our lives. But he said that how you view your place in this hierarchy is based off of this very deep, under many, many layers, basically an internal calculator in your brain, a dominance hierarchy calculator. And you calculate your place in the hierarchy, a score. You get a score from this calculator based off of lots of input. So if you just, you know, lob, you know, fat jokes to me for an hour, then I take all that in. I'm going to calculate my dominance hierarchy score is going to be lower. And therefore, the consequences of which will be, my confidence will lower. I'll probably get maybe feel a little bit bad, or my anxiety will grow and I will get depressed. And I won't just feel that. I'll probably go to Safeway and get Little Debbie's, you know? Mm. It's just this cruel cycle.
Did you say diabetes or Little Debbie's? Aren't there's a lot of similarities thing? In those words.
There's similarities both in caloric content and semantics. But I think I really got that because words as vehicles of joy or sadness, really, they're really, we're really affected by what other people say about us. And our perceptions of how people think of us really do affect our place on this ladder. And maybe it doesn't have to be called a dominance hierarchy. Maybe it's just a hierarchy of
dominance.
Sure, maybe. But that, you know, I do tend to be really affected by people's or my perception of their perception of me and their words. And if someone says something encouraging to me, my score shoots through the roof. And when someone says something bad to me, my score just goes way down. And maybe that's because I'm kind of lower on the hierarchy. Typically confident people, this stuff just bounces off of confident people.
Right, right.
You know what I mean? And that's because they have a high score on this internal calculator. And that's what we all want. That's where we all want to be, because while we're down here in the dregs, something negative happens to us and it just makes us even worse and worse and worse. And it's just this negative feedback loop that never ends. The inverse is also true on the opposite side. When someone says something good to us, it boosts our confidence. And then that's a positive feedback loop that just reaps dividends. So I do think that's true. At least that's how I think I have been operating in this crazy life of mine. But this, I mean, largely, if I understood this maybe in my 20s, my 30s would have been a little bit different. Because I think I've been hanging out on the bottom rung of the dominance hierarchy. And through some discussions in this show, you and I have talked about breaking negative feedback loops, haven't we? And what sometimes it takes just some self-leadership and standing up with our shoulders back, instilling confidence in us when we have really no reason to feel it. But sometimes you have to start taking steps towards confidence and happiness and joy by doing things and not the opposite. So that's why I think maybe that's why I was so note heavy on our document here, because the first chapter really did speak to me. And
yeah,
I thought it was very meaningful because I felt that I have kind of gone through this and have an innate understanding of my own place in the hierarchy. And I now know what lowers my position and what increases my position, my station, if you will. So I do think that, and you've talked about your own experience here where you were on the lower, you had a lower score. It was just a self-perpetuating thing. So I do think that this is a good way to start. And are we going to, you know, utilize this level of detail every chapter? Probably not. We might even skip a chapter or two, but at least this first chapter, I think, was a great way to start this series. Because a lot of these things that Peterson talks about in these books, you and I have already talked about. Now we just get to use different language. Mm-hmm. So there you go. Not a bad start.
Yeah. So I have three things to say, but I can say them briefly. Yeah. Listeners should know I normally prepare more copious notes, but right now I'm looking at three lines that I wrote down while Jim was talking. Okay. So I want to defend why I said that I think youth pastors are the lowest form of crustacean. I don't think this is universally the case, but I also want to lump people who work at colleges into this, like the Andy Bernard.
You are just like coming at me in places I never really thought you would. This is interesting.
You know the Andy Bernard character?
Yeah.
Who, like, when he was at college, he felt like, so his dad, I'm going to get really deep into the psychology of Andy Bernard. And I feel like you could never do this with a Parks and Rec character. Really does speak to the quality of The Office. But Andy Bernard's dad wanted a son who was not Andy. The son that he had after Andy was Josh Groban. Like played by Josh Groban.
Yeah.
And you can imagine not living up to being Josh Groban. That was Andy's life. That's tough. So they literally changed Andy's name. I don't remember. He named Andy his own name, and then Andy turned into Andy. And so when he had the second son, he named the second son his own name and changed Andy's name to Andy. And like that kind of sets the tone for his existence. And then he went to Cornell. You heard of it. And he found a home there. He got a nickname. Right. He joined an a cappella group. He felt like he had really come into his own. And then he stepped out from college into the world. And I think this is a very common problem, which is why they wrote the character this way. He stepped out into the world and like just collapsed in on himself because the thing about college students is that they're more easily impressed than 35-year-olds that you're trying to sell paper to.
Yes.
Or a car or whatever Jim does. Because that clearly resonated
with him.
And at the end of the series, I don't mean to spoil anything, but he ends up going back and doing, I think it's like admissions or something at Cornell. And he finds this home there because, you know, he's not that impressive a person. You know, he's pretty good at singing, but not excellent. He's not a good salesperson. He's not good at like technical stuff.
Not a good leader.
He's not a good leader. He is, he likes acting, but he's too character-y to be a normal person. And he's not fat enough to be a comedy guy. I think that's what Kevin says about him. And so he ends up going back to Cornell.
I'm basically Andy.
He ends up going back to Cornell and his life ends up being just being around people who are like 20 years younger than he is.
Sure. Yeah.
And they're all really impressed with him because he can sing and harmonize and do all these things that like they never learned to do yet because they're 19. And
that is excellent characterization that you just did. So I'm impressed with both you and the writers.
Yeah.
A really well thought out character.
And I think that thing affects people a lot, that like you just kind of go back to a point in your life where maybe you felt like you were on top, or maybe you, like for me, when I became a youth leader, I was not on top. But I got to revisit that as a youth leader and kind of be on top. And it made me feel good.
Yeah.
And it would have been really tempting to stay there. And I think for a lot of youth pastors, that may be something that happened where they weren't sure what to do with their life. They felt kind of like a loser. But man, all these teenagers are really impressed with me. And in a lot of cases, it is for horribly nefarious purposes, but not even necessarily for nefarious purposes. It's just this notion that like, this is where I fit. This is where I belong. Like these people like me, I'm helping them. Like, why would I not want to be here? Right. And so that's what I meant by the lowest form of crustacean. I have to wonder if for a lot of youth pastors, the reason they find themselves where they are is because they tried a few other places. They were the shrunken, soft, sad lobster going into those places. It went poorly for them. And so they went into youth ministry where like, it's pretty easy to feel on top of the world because these kids don't even know how to drive yet. And it works for them. And that's where they found their home. I'm not saying that's the case with all youth pastors. Obviously a lot of them have really good intentions and it's possible to be in that exact thing that I described and have really good intentions. I'm just saying this is what ran through my mind, not because, oh, I look down on these people, but because that's where I think I was.
Well, I hope by now, we probably don't have a whole lot of youth pastors that still listen to this show because they've had enough comments come their way that they've long ago deleted this podcast.
You know what the difference between a youth pastor and a large pizza is?
What?
A large pizza can feed a small family.
Okay. Well, that's true. I think all youth pastors would agree with that. But that I'm just saying, if there are any youth pastors left still watching or listening to this show, I think that finally did them in.
Yeah, I'd like to think they either stopped listening or they converted.
Let us hope. Okay.
Not to Christianity, but to not being a youth pastor.
Okay. All right.
Next up, I wanted to say that these things ought not be this way. While you have the Matthew 24 principle, as you called it, you also have the whoever wants to be the greatest should be the servant of all.
Right. That's a good solution.
And yeah, that is the solution. The solution is that the people who have much, what's expected of them is not that they gain more and more and more and more and become super powerful mega lobsters. What's expected of them is that they help the smaller lobsters instead of fighting them.
I once heard someone, and I use this now, give a definition of biblical manhood to me. And they said biblical manhood is utilizing your strength. And by strength, that could mean your literal strength, your success, your influence, your accumulation, what have you, using that to serve. But that's a good definition of masculinity, is using your strength to serve others. And that can apply to both to males, females, anybody. But I've always thought that was just a profoundly Christian message. And that is a solution to this dominance hierarchy. For those who are in the lower spots, those that are above can reach down and serve those in the lower ranks to lift them up.
Yeah.
It's a profoundly Christian thing.
And then lastly, I know that there are some listeners out there who heard us talk about the number that Peterson and Jim talked about, the number that you assign yourself.
Ah, the score.
Right. And that is spectrum thinking. And I know what you're thinking. Hey, David, don't you have objections? And I kind of do. So I just want to briefly explain that I do think this is complicated because I think that for humans anyway, I can't speak of lobsters because they're fairly singularly minded. For humans, we have a lot of things that we have scores on. Some of them pertain to social interactions. Some of them pertain to technical or job skills. Some of them may pertain to matters of love and romance, which could almost be a whole separate category from just regular social skills. And I think that while these numbers are independent, that you can feel like you're a 30 in the love spectrum, but like a 95 in the technical job abilities skill or segment. There are times where your number in one area goes down so low that you find it untenable, unbelievable that you could have a high score anywhere else. And so that the number in your social interactions make you think that you can't even operate a computer because you're just bad at everything. And that has to do with cycles of depression and all of that. But I do want to admit that I think there is nuance on these numbers, that if you're occupying the mid 60s in a few different areas and like the 30s in another area, that may mean that this only affects you in one way. Like it may be that you're a really good people person, but I know a guy who's a really good people person. He's really friendly. Like, I don't know that he would ever, I don't know this for a fact, but I don't know that he would ever like suspect that people don't like him, that people don't like to be his friend and stuff. But at the same time, he's really struggled professionally to find a career and he really is down on himself and thinks he's bad at most things.
I think you're right. But if you're lower on this hierarchy, because of the negative feedback loops that we've talked about, because of the self-perpetuating nature of being lower on this, the fact that you score higher in other categories may not even matter because you have no perception of it.
Exactly.
Because you're just so low, you know? So yeah, you're right. Maybe that's the solution out of it. Having someone trusted come along and tell you these things, positive reinforcement, raising your score, whatever. But yeah, you're right. It's better to probably think of this as numerous scores rather than one, but it's hard to see that when you're down in there.
Yeah. And I get the desire to have a call, especially when you're just writing a book that can't be like 97 chapters. I totally understand how there's a sense in which you can, like you said, you may be a 90 at technical skills, but because you're a 20 at social skills and a 5 at like love and romance, like you just kind of, it doesn't matter that you're a 90. Like the only thing that matters to you right now is having friends and finding that special someone. And that's the only thing that's on your mind. And it doesn't really matter to you that you go into work and crush it every day. It just doesn't matter because you feel like you're a 2 because that's all that matters to you is these other things in your life that you can't get right.
It's a tough place to be. It really is.
Yeah.
And, while the title of the chapter may sound overtly simplistic, standing up with your shoulders back, maybe the first thing you have to do, but yeah. But hey, you know, we're going to have to cut this discussion short. I think this is a great start to this series, this little book club that we're doing. We won't necessarily do this next time. We have an FCU episode next. Then after that, we may continue on or we may do a different topic, but we'll definitely come back to this and progress as the year, the new year goes on. So, but a good start, David.
Yeah.
I think next time we'll have a little bit more time to allocate to talk about this because we kind of had to zip through things, but I think we did a good job.
Yeah. I will definitely be either reading or listening to the rest of the book because I mean, his solution of stand up straight with your shoulders back I felt like it kind of felt rushed and overly simplistic at the end in the way that most self-help books are, but I still found his analysis of the problem to be very helpful and I'm very interested to hear him talk about other things.
Fair enough. Well, we'll go ahead and end it here. Thank you all for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
All right. Bye, everybody. Bye, all 7 of you.
Won't someone save me from this podcast? Is it over or just dragging along? Will these two guys talk forever? Or will they quit if I sing them this song? And now the sky will be tough, but 90 minutes for this conversation just won't be enough. Won't someone save me from this podcast? The torture started off so tongue-in-cheek. Now it seems it's almost over. So I